Today to Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 9. Well, I'll begin at chapter 8 and verse 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 13. For I mean not that other men be eased and ye burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want. And our subject is gifts, stewardship, monetary gifts, or gifts of time and energy given in Christian service. These principles could apply to all these things, but the immediate context is the relief of the poverty in Jerusalem at the time of the Apostle Paul. And here in verse 13, we begin our study on gifts and the principle of sowing and reaping. It's not very often we touch on this subject. In fact, somewhat rarely. But we come to it in the course of consecutive studies in 2 Corinthians. And so we look at the instructions given by God through the apostle in these passages. And in verse 13, I mean not that other men be eased and ye burdened, but by an equality, an interesting word for the Apostle Paul to use. This is a range of matters connected with giving in all its forms, and it's so important to us, especially in these days with the prosperity gospel people twisting these passages and misinterpreting them as they love to do. But we come and we see what the Lord really requires of us. My first heading is open-heartedness. That'll be the initial theme of the apostle, open-heartedness. Verse 14, but by an equality. So, first of all, the churches of Macedonia made their gifts for the relief of poverty in Jerusalem. I touched on this in a previous study. You'll know that after the day of Pentecost, this is some years later, but after the day of Pentecost, there were so many thousands of Jewish people who were converted to Christ. And following the day of Pentecost, thousands more. And the number was enormous in Jerusalem. But the prevailing nationalism among the Jews for their religion and for their security under the Romans, hated this. And people who professed Christ would be put out of their homes, their businesses would collapse, and they would be in very great need. And this continued in phases right up and through the time of the ministry of Paul. And so the Gentile churches, not only by direction from Paul, but often through their own initiative, as in Macedonia, from their own poverty, raised these great offerings to assist the people in Jerusalem. And now the apostle is organizing a particular collection, if you like, round the churches of several regions to bring this about further. And he uses this term, but by an equality. And at first sight, when we see that word, you almost wonder if it's a form of communism creeping in. If the suggestion is here, but it's impossible, of course, that the churches and Christian people should all have the same. And there should be a leveling among them, a kind of principle of equality in that sense. But as we read it, it's quite plain that it's not equality of substance. There are great differences between believers, but it's an equality of care and kindness. And the apostle says in verse 14, but by an equality, literally the Greek, which is translated here equality, means likeness, that there may be a likeness, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want or need, that their abundance also And what is implied here is at some other time may be a supply for your want. Now that's the sense of the original quite clearly. That now at this time is a very of great significance in the original grammar. Now at this time your abundance may be a supply, so that at some other time, that's what's not supplied, but it's intended, their abundance may be a supply for your need. And in this way there shall be equality, likeness, a likeness of care. The offering from the Corinthians and the Macedonians and others directed to Jerusalem may be much more or much less than the offering that will come in the reverse direction should the circumstances be reversed. It's not an equality or a likeness of quantity, but here of character, that your kindness will be similarly exercised by them should the position be reversed. So although it's a largely technical matter, I thought we should look at that and mention that right from the beginning. Now the Church of Rome has an even different interpretation from this. Ever anxious to find justification in the Bible, for which there's none, for their hierarchical system and their dominating pope and bishops and so on, so that the individual churches and the individual supposed Christians are at the bottom of the stack and are nothing, the authority is all top down from above, they take this passage and look at the way they twist it, and no way is it the sense of the original grammar. But they twist it to mean this, that now at this time your abundance, your money, may be a supply for their want, that their abundance, and they interpret this as Rome's authority and teaching and direction, may supply your want. You need, it's not Rome in this case, it's Jerusalem, but soon it will be Rome, that Jerusalem, the Mother Church, will direct you and give you the authority and direction, and you will give to them your substance in their need. Well, of course, that's not like at all. That's not equality at all. It's benevolence and care. What you give to Jerusalem, they may one day need to be giving to you the same care and benevolence and support, nothing to do with the justification of the Catholic and Episcopal systems of church government. So that is largely technical, but that's our beginning, and the Apostle makes that clear. And he has a wonderful example in verse 15, because he quotes Exodus 16, the example of the manna, as it is written, "He that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack." Now that doesn't make a lot of sense in this context, unless, I'm not going to do it now, but unless you refer back to Exodus 16 and you note the method that was followed in the giving of the manna. The people went out to collect the manna, and some people collected much and some collected much less. We can only guess at the reason. Perhaps it was the hale and hearty that collected much, and the aged and the feeble collected little. But that didn't affect the distribution, because the manna was brought together and then measured out to the families according to their need, according to the mouths to feed, and so on, so that there was a similarity in the care. God provided and everyone was provided for. And that's the principle of the giving of relief. It's the principle of giving to the Lord's work. It's the principle of every effort that we expend in Christian service. And that is that all must be served and helped. Benevolence is to all. But now come down to verse 16, where the theme changes a little. And I'm going to talk about a second heading, the priority of the gospel. But thanks be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. It's amazing how the inspired apostle always speaks. We sometimes think so differently, and always he is the same. He doesn't say, first and foremost, we're thankful for Titus. We're thankful that he had a caring heart, that he came to minister to you, that he gave himself to you, that he was concerned for you. He says, we thank God that he put this spirit into the heart of Titus. It is God's doing. Is there no credit to Titus? Yes, there is some. He didn't suppress or extinguish the gift of God or the movement of the Spirit of God, but the prime praise is for God. And you see what happens when you think like this. Thanks be to God. The believers in Jerusalem, when they received the assistance and the support, would first and foremost thank God. Only secondary would they be grateful to the Macedonians and to the Corinthians and to Titus, the bearer of the relief and his party. First of all, they would be grateful to God. They would see it as a movement of God who moved through his people to do this. And so they would get a tremendous benefit and assurance. God cares for us. God has done this great thing for us. So they thank God more than they thank the messenger. And that should be our practice too. It's the Lord who is expressing his care for us by moving in the heart of Titus and the others who inspired the giving. Then secondly, there is some credit for Titus, verse 17. For indeed, he accepted the exhortation, but being more forward of his own accord, he went unto you. But God comes first, and Titus second, when a benefit is given or received. And that's an unfailing principle of the apostle right through the epistles. And verse 18 brings us to something which is curious at first, but very instructive about the priority of the gospel. And we have sent with him, with Titus, the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. Well, human curiosity has always come to this verse and said, who was this second brother? And much of the print in the commentaries is dedicated to trying to decide who is the second brother, who is not named. And all kinds of suggestions are made. I suppose the most popular suggestion is Luke. But there are all kinds of reasons advanced why it couldn't have been Luke. And then Barnabas is advanced. But there are more reasons given as to why it couldn't have been Barnabas. And then Silas is proposed. But it's unlikely to have been Silas because he was already known to the Corinthians. So he wouldn't have been introduced in this manner as though he were a stranger to them. And then Aristarchus is proposed by many esteemed people. But there are reasons why it couldn't have been Aristarchus too, who was incidentally a Macedonian himself. In a sense, if you want a suggestion, the favorite is probably Tychicus, for the simple reason that nobody's got any reasons why it shouldn't be Tychicus. But that's not really a good reason for supposing it would have been him. Paul, tantalizingly, doesn't name the second brother. Neither does he name the third brother who was in the party, who's coming up in a moment. So the question is, why doesn't he name him? Because he usually names the messengers. So why are these names left silent? And the first suggestion that's made is that to name him might take away the attention from Titus. And the point is being made that Titus is the official representative of the apostle. But even more important, there are incidental things which are very important. And if you named the person, you might just obscure them. So we'll look at them. And the first and the chief one is this. We have sent with him, verse 18, the brother, unnamed, whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches, which means who is praised for his preaching and upholding of the gospel by all the churches that he has hitherto visited. He is among those who is acclaimed as a gospel man. He preaches frequently and constantly persuasive, clear gospel sermons, calling to sinners to repent, exhorting, remonstrating, appealing to them. He's a gospel man. But why do you need a gospel man, we might ask, to collect money for the relief of Jerusalem, which is where the people of God, who are very numerous, are in poverty? Why do you want a gospel man? Well, for one reason, this brother, this unnamed brother, will clearly also be preaching and ministering as well as collecting. But for other reasons too, because it shows his heart. And because the Bible, the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, doesn't want relief work ever to become as important or more important than the gospel. So they make sure they have somebody who is first and foremost known for his concern for the gospel and his preaching of the gospel. He won't go out of balance. He won't drift from the mark. He won't get it wrong. Today, a lot of people get it wrong, and people whose hearts are probably in the right place. And so you'll find many churches saying, oh, relief and compassionate work is as important as the gospel. And the illustration is used, they're two wings of a bird, and they're equal, but they're not in the Bible. Yes, if we have opportunity to do good, we must. But the gospel always has the priority. It's the chief thing and the main thing for us. So a brother is appointed whose praise is in the gospel throughout the churches, and it shows his heart. And the second principle is that he's not only been set aside by his church, but others have been asked, verse 19, and not that only, but who was also chosen of the churches, in the plural. So they've taken the trouble, as this is something on behalf of all the churches, to consult the other churches. Will this brother and that brother be acceptable to you? And these are men who are absolutely trusted, and so they're appointed. So get an insight into the early church and how it's operated. And this is important because of verse 20. Avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance, no man should find fault with us in this abundance which is administered by us. Or as we might say today, no man should find fault with our administration of the funds. They were so careful that the ministers, the preachers, should be above any accusation. It could never be said that they were cheating, they were taking. They wouldn't, of course, but it should never be possible for anyone to suggest it, that they had scope to do so. And so there's a multiplicity of trusted people brought in to administer and to look after the funds. That's another reason why we can't trust these people who are so-called prosperity teachers. with their wealth and their plundering of stewardship and funds that are given to them. They don't fit in. They don't obey the New Testament pattern in any sense. Verse 21, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. And then verse 22, a third unnamed brother. And we have sent with them our brother, that's another one, whom we have oftentimes proved diligent in many things. Who was he? But now much more diligent upon the great confidence which I have in you. And then, verse 23, whether any do inquire of Titus, should there be anyone in Corinth, but surely not. He is my partner and fellow helper concerning you. And then Paul goes on to say at the end of verse 23, and this is very special, they are the messengers of the churches and the glory of Christ. What a title to put on God's servants. These collectors of funds for Jerusalem are described as not only the messengers of the churches and the glory of Christ. What does that mean? How can mere men be the glory of Christ? Well, because they represent or personify the care of Christ. The glory of Christ is to be ever present with his people and to care for them. He knows our condition. He is ever with us. His great glory is to watch over us. See it in the messengers who take the great offering to Jerusalem. They represent, they depict the very glory of Christ operating in the relief of his own people. And then, verse 24, wherefore show ye to them, and this is for us, listen to this, wherefore show ye to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. Show the proof, the tokens is the Greek, the evidence of your love. Don't we need that so often? We say we love one another, but do we show the evidence? Do we express it? Do we take the trouble to express it in some shape or form? Or is it closed up in our hearts? It's our secret love. Love for fellow believers. Love for the gospel. This is a great text. One year you could have it as an annual proof text, personally. Wherefore show ye to them the proof of your love. Sometimes people say they can be passed by a fellow Christian in a busy church, in a corridor, and not even be acknowledged. We need to show the proof of our brotherliness and sisterliness. That's the exhortation here. By your offerings, says the Apostle Paul, by all sorts of things, express your brotherly affection within the family. Now I come to a third heading, and for this I'm going into chapter 9, and I'm going down to verse 6, because the first five verses of chapter 9 really do apply to the Corinthians. But in verse 6 we can continue the theme, and the heading will be spiritual factors in giving. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Well, that's obvious. The illustration of the farmer. If he's mean in his sowing, if he sows the seed in the spirit of one who thinks he's losing something, he's throwing something away, then he'll get a poor yield. But if he sows generously, then he will get a good yield. And this is a principle for Christian stewardship or giving. It is a principle, without doubt. The farmer, of course, does not consider the seed as being lost because it's left his possession and been buried in the ground. He sees it as a gain in many ways. And that's what God authorizes us to do. It's followed by an exhortation accordingly. But when we sow in gifts, whether for relief, whether for the Lord's work, whether we're sowing in terms of time and energy in Christian service and witness, we must not see it as something we've parted with, that time, that energy, those means. They are sown and they bring forth fruit if they're sincerely sown with goodwill. Calvin has a wonderful passage on this. He says, when you give a gift, the old nature, the flesh, protests. But that's mine, it says. I'm going to lose it. I shan't see it again. That's mine. Well then, says Calvin, answer the flesh with your reason. And say to your flesh, from your mind, from your reason, yes, you may say I'm losing this. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 6, God says, I'm not losing it, I'm sowing it. And it will reap a harvest, and he will bless it in ways I cannot imagine. So answer the flesh, and don't let it hinder the gift, the giving. There's an authority in verse 6. Don't let the authority be weakened by the fact it comes in the form of an illustration. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. How do we reap? Now the prosperity gospel says that if you give money, you'll receive money. If you sow money, you'll reap money. You will be enriched. But Scripture doesn't say that. And the Apostle Paul here has no time for monetary enrichment. He explains that the enrichment is spiritual. Verse 7, every man according as he purposeth in his heart, if you're sincere, and your mind is really on the objective that you're giving to, the Christian work or the plight of the people who are being relieved, every man according as he intends in his heart to do good, so let him give, not grudgingly, that is reluctantly, or of necessity, that is out of mere duty. For God loveth a cheerful giver. And a happy giver embraces willingness and desire to be a blessing. And the enrichment comes in verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound, superabound, is the Greek, toward you. Wouldn't you much rather have all grace than money? All grace. God is able to make all grace abound. So he'll provide for you in so many ways. He'll give you assurance. He'll give you understanding. He'll give you spiritual happiness. He'll give you spiritual opportunities. He'll give you so many things which are graces. God is able to make all grace, every form of gift of God, abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency, read contentment there. That's what it amounts to. All sufficiency. You'll be wholly content with what is given you and what you have. In all things, you'll be so pleased at the perfect wisdom of God and what is apportioned to you, that ye always having all sufficiency in all things may abound to every good work. And the good works in mind in this passage are works of kindness. Whether they're gospel witness, whether they're relief, whether they're helpfulness to one another, every good work of outgoing kindness. As it is written, Psalm 112, verse 9, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever, which probably means he won't be forgotten. And nor will your benevolence ever fade. Once you start practicing it, it'll be natural to you, and God will help you. It'll never fade. Now the prayer of the apostle, now he that ministereth seed to the sower, he gave you everything you have. Both minister bread for your food. May he look after you. He will, of course. And multiply your seed sown, your ability to give, and increase the fruits, the results of your righteousness, which means here your kindness. Being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, so that you become more and more able to be generous, which causeth through us thanksgiving to God. And the object of your generosity and your efforts and your expending time, energy, money, ultimately will be the praise of God. That's the great objective. That's what we want. We want the relief of the poor saints in Jerusalem. But more than that, we want the ultimate objective, that they'll praise and thank the Lord for his faithfulness. That's the aim. And then Paul repeats, it's so important for the administration of this service, verse 12, not only supplieth the want of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings unto God. It's thankfulness to God that we're aiming at. And then he repeats it yet again in verse 13, but I'm out of time. And he repeats it yet again in a sense in verse 14, by bringing in their prayer for you. Don't you know they'll pray for you? And they'll long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you. In other words, thanking God for his grace in you. And the final verse, that wonderful verse, which is about Christ. Thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. God gave the greatest gift of all, Christ the Lord. And Christ gave the gift we all depend on, Calvary's cross and his atoning death and his imputed righteousness. And he's the example, and he's the Lord. By nature we are mean, with Christ in us and the new nature, we have a giving ethos. Thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift, which means, a word which means, that the narrative of Christ and the glories of Christ can never be fully expressed. They are so great and so extensive. We can talk about some of them on earth, and we shall be in heaven forever exploring the rest, and we'll never be through. Thanks be unto God for the supreme gift, which can never be fully described. It is so gracious and so wonderful and so kind, and that is the gift that should be stamped to some extent in every one of us. Let's close our thinking singing. Well, we cannot sing, but contemplating the hymn 608, hymn number 608.